Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause in keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. So I wanted to start off by reading something called the Metta Sutta, which is a teaching that the Buddha offered on this kind of beautiful quality of mind. It's actually called an illimitable quality, or sometimes called a Brahma Vihara, a boundless quality of mind that he encouraged us to cultivate. And he delivered this sutta. I think it's so beautiful, so I just want to read it. It kind of helped me reflect a little bit before I talk. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened by duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they're weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So we can go home now. Pretty good teaching in itself. Yeah, I like reading this because it kind of helps me reorient to like what I'm doing here. I've been on retreat. I've shared this before several times, like silent retreat, and you're like a week into retreat. And just have had like these intense moments of doubt where I'm just like, what the fuck am I even doing here? You know, like, why did I sign up for this? Or what am I just supposed to sit here and my mind's just supposed to wander and antagonize me and criticize me and judge everyone, right? And this kind of like, Scott and I have been talking a little bit about like our Western conditioning. And I think sometimes we look at our current state of mind to judge our progress, right? Like our practice is contingent on how we feel in the moment or what's happening in the moment. So sometimes it's helpful to have some things to, it says in this sutta, to sustain this recollection, to like recollect. I like that word a little bit. It's like recollect. It's like collect the attention back into something wholesome or something skillful or something supportive. You know, like so in moments of doubt or like moments when I'm really struggling or tripping about some shit, it's like trying to get some sense of ground. And we do this in a few ways through meditation practice in particular. It's like getting a sense of ground through the body, right? Like we did tonight through sounds, through the sense of kind of feeling into the flow of the breath in the body or the weight of the body sitting. This is really powerful. This helps to develop what the Buddha referred to as samadhi, or collectedness of awareness. Scott was talking about the monkey mind this morning, and he shared it a couple times, but I love the image. He said that in India, if a monkey gets into a temple, they just like wreck everything, you know, like throwing all of the stuff around and making a mess. And this is like what our mind is like. And there's not even really a problem with that. That's just kind of how the mind is the mind thinks. It's its job. It gets paid to think. But the mind causes us a lot of problems. And so remembering a ground means, in recollection, it means to recollect ourselves back into something that's just as simple, as I said earlier tonight, is just the weight of the hands. It's kind of like feeling that. It's almost like kind of a reminder to the mind. It's like, oh, you're here, right? And then the mind can kind of pour down into the body and get a sense of, its place. Because we spend so much time in other places, the future, the past, they call this representational thinking in psychology, which I kind of like, because it's like we think about things that represent, moments that have already happened, that have already passed, or moments that haven't even happened yet, right? Or just complete fantasies. And the mind's very powerful, because it constructs, we've been talking about the mind a little bit the past couple weeks, it constructs our worldview, it orders our values, it eventually, leads into our behavior, into how we speak and act and react. And when we're not conscious of the mind, it can, spill out into our relationships, into our jobs, into the worlds that we live in. So this recollection of this ground of the body is a foundation in Buddhist meditation. Then there's this recollection of not only what we focus our attention into, but how, right? And this is kind of the relational aspect of meditation. Every moment, it's not only looking at what's occurring in the moment, but how we relate to what's occurring. I like to kind of give this visual. It's like if there's a thought that just sweeps in and grabs the attention, we oftentimes have this kind of judgment or this initial reaction. That shouldn't be happening, right? Especially if we spend a lot of time with that plan, like 5 minutes of the meditation. But really, it's kind of a shame, because as soon as we're aware that we've been in that thought, even for 5 minutes, it's like that awareness is a seed of awakening. It's literally like waking up. And it's like, oh, planning again. So when we see that the mind's wandering, there's this kind of way of relating. There's this way of making contact with that thought. And we can practice a gentle contact. It's like, oh, I see you, mind. The Buddha did this in the kind of mythological story of his awakening, being attacked by the enemies, or the forces, I should say, of Mara. And, this greed and hatred and delusion just spilling through his mind. And all he would do is just say, I see you, Mara. Just kind of this acknowledgement of seeing clearly, and also having, sometimes we have to have limits with our mind. Like sometimes I tell my mind, all right, enough. Like I'm done with that story about my boss right now. I'm not going to figure that one out. And then we can get kind of back into the body and feel into that underlying kind of emotional energy of fear. Let's call it fear. But that rushing and flowing of contraction and that kind of like fluttering feeling that we carry around in the body, we can come back into that ground, but we can also then come into the body with a gentle contact. We can ease into those places where we feel anxiety, like in a sweet way. I call this making space. It's one of my, I sometimes pick up little themes like that that are simple. They mean something to me, you know, and it helps me to kind of get a, pick up a theme of what am I doing when I'm practicing, you know, trying to meet my experience with kindness. I'm just trying to make space. It's like inviting and kind of welcoming. And this is really counter, and it can be kind of subtle. So I'm not trying to really even do anything with that energy in the body. I'm just seeing if I can almost make space for it and kind of like go into it in a gentle way. And this is kind of trippy because like when people come and see me in my private practice, like clients and people that I work with, a lot of times, you know, we have, because we're anxious animals, a lot of anxiety. And I'm usually inviting them to kind of sit in those feelings in the room. And we get to sit in those feelings in the room together and be with those feelings together. And there's something I can't even really describe. I don't think words even really matter. But there's something really powerful about just being present and being present with someone else in what the experience is. And it's usually the last thing that I want to do. It's like my last strategy. Today, it's like probably my fourth or fifth. It's like I'm, you know, instead of my 20th, it's like I'll go to the fridge and get a bowl of ice cream. We had some ice cream right before this. You know, whatever. I always make jokes about like texting the ex or like, you know, we know the things that we do, right? Anything but be with the loneliness. Anything but be with that hollow, pitted, sinking feeling in the body. And so I like this word, and the Buddha kind of used it a lot. It was one of the translations is abiding. And I looked up the definition for abiding, and it means something like patiently bearing with. Right? So patiently bearing with these parts of ourselves, there's love in that, right? And this word, Scott did a great job talking about the word love the past couple days, because we can sometimes in the Western world have this kind of, I think he used the word goopy kind of idea of love, which is almost this kind of like enmeshed, kind of attached sense of, it's like a claustrophobic sense of like mine. It's almost a possessiveness, yeah, but really, you know, this type of love is like truly unconditional in that it's not about, it's not about closing in on ourselves, right? And it's not about even really doing anything other than this abiding, this patiently bearing with. And I'll say one more thing, and I'd love to hear what Scott wants to share on this. But this is where I like using kind of like symbols or visual representations, because these things help me to connect with a sense of like, where have I felt this before? Because like I said on retreat, when I kind of forget, when I'm tripping really bad and I'm like, no love in here, no kindness. I know I should be, right? There's that dangerous thing, kind or loving, but I don't feel like I can access it. Sometimes it helps to have some type of like practice around what in the commentaries, the Visuddhimagga, they talk about like practicing metta or kindness towards like a benefactor, almost as a recollection exercise. And so like imagining someone, like I use my grandma. I actually have this grimace tattoo, the purple character from McDonald's, because I call my grandma Grimace. And she hates my tattoo, so I got her one. And I love my grandma, and I like to say that she's not even particularly really nice. Like my grandma's kind of like a little mean, but she's totally non-judgmental. Like I can't say anything to her where she'd close off her love from me. I could literally do anything, which is probably a little dangerous, But she has this like lightness with me. She's like fully present, and she has this kind of like, yeah, this light kind of relationship, this presence with me, this patience bearing with me. And so sometimes it helps to even practice, and maybe we'll do a little bit of the practice later tonight if we get to it, but you know, like kind of envisioning these beings. And sometimes it's easier to start with like a pet because they don't have a lot of personality, you know, to project onto. And these beings also, we got to be careful not to have like this expectation that these beings have to be perfect, right? But we're trying to sense into the goodness in these beings. Like, what is the goodness? What is the lightness and the joy? Where is that in these beings? I try to just imagine like my grandma like laughing, or like my dog when I come home, like wiggling his butt, and like getting the sense of trying to really connect with that. And this is a meditation practice you can do too. Just kind of connecting with that. And then I'll even just kind of offer some kind or loving phrases to that being. May you be at ease. May you be at peace. And that's the whole practice. And sometimes, oftentimes when I do my home practice, this is like every other day, I'll do a metta practice. Or I'll maybe start with this benefactor, they call it. May you be at ease, may you be at peace. I just keep coming back. And of course, my mind wanders and gets distracted or reactive, whatever. But I just notice that, and then I'm kind to my mind. I say, may you be at ease, may you be at peace, and I come back to the image. So this is one way to kind of practice with this. It helps us during times where we or maybe really struggling to have a sense of some symbols or images or people that help us to connect with this intention.
So, I don't know quite what I want to say, but thanks for all what you said.
Yeah, for sure.
I appreciate it. You know, as Andrew's talking, I was thinking and often, I just notice what's arising for me intuitively sometimes and let that guide the talk. Sometimes I prepare, sometimes I don't. And I've been doing this series in New York City regularly in Lower Manhattan on a text from the Tibetan tradition called the 7-point mind training, which is basically coming from a tradition called Lojong. Some of you may have heard of. In Tibetan, it means mind training. Basically, they're techniques and tools we use to train the mind in loving kindness, to train the mind in compassion. Its root comes out of places like this Metta Sutra, but it's also made adaptations into Mahayana Buddhism and then into Tibet. And the theme that kept coming up in this text again and again, you know, some of you, have you heard of Tonglen, this practice where you give and take through the breath? Yeah? So that's basically, it comes out of this text, it comes out of this tradition of mind training that started in the time of the Buddha and made its way through India and then eventually into Tibet. And it's a little hardcore sometimes, you know, because the practice actually is to mount on your breath the suffering of others and to take that on and then to imagine giving them all of your happiness. So it's kind of like the Metta Sutta on speed, like, you know, like it's like, it's not, it's kind of intense, but it's very powerful and actually can shift our experience quite quickly. And we can start to experience transformation. And so we're exploring every Monday night, what's at the heart of this transformation. And really what the text comes down to is starting to, through first, it's like what Andrew was saying, our first line of defense in working to have a happier mind and working to have more inspiration, joy in our life is to become aware, is to just come into the present moment, to be able to start to see more clearly what's happening with our minds, more specifically our thinking minds. What kinds of thoughts are we engaging in daily, and how is that conditioning our experience? Is that making me a happier person, or is that making me suffer more? So that's kind of the topic of this morning's talk, which was that our mind essentially is the creator of our happiness or the creator of our pain or dissatisfaction. And based on that, when we begin to have a little bit of connection to a presence and a bit of a connection to an awareness of what we're thinking and how we're behaving, we can start to see actually what the true enemy is in our experience. You know, normally when we get angry, when we get upset, we find an outer enemy to blame. I usually, you know, I blame my couch because it was in my way, right? And then my foot stubbed on it. Joking. But anyways, you know, sometimes we do stupid things like that. Like, all, you know, just blame my couch. It's all its fault. But there's nothing there. I'm the one who ran into the couch, right? So anyways, so this text that I'm teaching Monday night, it really comes down to the point, and this is a little hardcore, but I was kind of feeling intuitively called to say it tonight, that actually the root of our suffering and pain is our own self-importance. And that's quite of a heavy statement. It doesn't make me feel good to say that. And usually I recognize when I don't feel good to necessarily say something, but it's a Dharma topic and there's truth to it, that's maybe a good thing. In the sense that I think we need to be challenged sometime. I think we can get a little lazy in our self-importance. You know, we sometimes come to meditation thinking, oh, I want a little peace. It's actually self-importance in disguise. And I'm not saying you shouldn't get peace. You shouldn't feel good. You shouldn't feel relaxed and at ease. That's what the sutta is saying. We first need to be really kind in that way. And then the kindness can go deeper into recognizing, hey, when I'm thinking all about me, is that making me more happy? Is that conditioning me out of my self-habit? Is that helping me to be more constructive in my communities, in my families? You know, normally when we talk this way in the West, we think of it like it's a martyr syndrome. Oh, well, I'm then going to become less selfish in order to act in the community in a less selfish way, or to be a better citizen, or a better father, a better mother, or a better whatever, right? No, no, no. The Buddha's saying, your self-habit is tanking your happiness. Your self-habit is literally destroying your life. And this is something to reflect on, again. I kind of put it out there more for your perusal, not as an order or a directive or a dogma, right? Just something to think about. I notice for me, every day, my self-habit is getting in the way, you know? My self-habit is causing me to act in certain ways or act out instead of from confidence, from sort of fear, you know, or expectation, or not seeing the worth of another. And I would say within that, not seeing the value and worth of myself, right? I think when we truly have value and worth and when we come into that, we start to see that everybody's important, right? We're not the only person in the world. The world does not revolve around us, is, you know, a common saying that we have in America. So this is tough love a little bit, you know, and the Buddha here, it even implies some of this. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, you know. The Buddha's saying in order to practice true love, we have to first look towards ourselves, have confidence, have self-respect, and then start to understand that the more we engage our self-habit, the more we kind of reify that and feed that, the more we suffer. And the less we're able to enter a space of love that's actually full. And we're not talking about here just about, again, this principle where love at the expense of ourselves. That's not what the Buddha's saying. He's talking about a collective love. Engaging in a sense of interdependence where our basis, our own happiness, is based on what another's happiness as well. So there's a big principle evolving here. And I will say, generally I find modern society works against this. So like I said this morning, and I'm repeating it a lot, this isn't your fault. But it's your responsibility to work on this, right? So it's not your fault because we're just conditioned into this. This is part of what we call in Buddhism overall samsaric conditioning. Right? But then our modern society takes advantage of this. It preys on this in order to produce. So I feel like one of the strongest things we could do if we want to fight, you know, injustice and economic injustice, whatever the issue is, we want our neighbors to be happier, we want our family to be happier, our friends, whoever, We have to work with our self-habit. We have to work to reduce it. I meet some people who naturally, they're like that. And I always think, man, how did these people get this way? It's so incredible. Because I'm a pretty selfish person, you know? At least to me, it feels that way. And I'm always like in awe of people who just give of themselves. But it's not like this selflessness that you can tell they're kind of, they're becoming a doormat. That's not the selflessness I'm talking about. That's not useful. Because there's no self-respect there, right? In Buddhism, we have self-respect. We have confidence. We're not a doormat for anybody. But there's love. And there's a sense of what I have is yours, right? I met a few people like this. Usually they're not Buddhist, strangely enough. Or a Christian or whatever. They might just be a secular person. Maybe they're good. Maybe they don't need it. Maybe they're doing the work already, right? They kind of got born in with some gifts. But the rest of us, if this sounds familiar, right, if you can relate to my experience, which is I'm caught in my self-habit all the time, we have to start to see what the true enemy is, right? We have to start to see, oh, when I indulge in my own neurosis, right? And I'm saying if you know better. If you don't know better, it's okay. But if you know better and I indulge in it again and again and again, it's my fault if my life is unhappy. It's no one else's fault. And once we start to recognize that, we start to have real self-respect and real choice and shift. So again, a little bit hard news, a little bit tough love and tough news. But this is true, no? Can anybody relate to this? Does anybody disagree? You're welcome to disagree. It's not a dogma. I'm just putting it out there for us to think about, right? To inquire into. It's definitely not a dogma. But this is a tough one because our self-habit is driving most of our life. It's saying, you got to get this, you got to do this. And so if you think about your life, what are most of our decisions predisposed upon? They're predisposed on, what am I going to get out of this, right? Now, what if we flip it onto, what can I give through doing this? Just try that once a day. Wake up and decide, okay, today I'm going to do one thing. Like for me, like I said, I'm a real selfish person. So it might be just like, not giving my girlfriend a hard time because the apartment's messy, you know, because I'm like a clean, neat freak, neurotic kind of person. And so that one day I'll just let it get really messy and I'm not going to bother her because I know it'll help her to not feel like the pressure to clean up. So it's like a small thing I can give her, you know, and I can take the pain of a dirty apartment, right? So just one thing a day to work with, one thing to try. And while we're doing it, we're not sacrificing ourselves. It's not like, again, like this martyrdom where we're putting ourselves as a doormat. I want you to recognize. I want you to look at your mind. How do you feel when that happens? How do you feel when you consciously decided, deliberately choose love? Because when, you know, as Andrew mentioned, I was talking about this difference between goopy love and the love the Buddha's talking about here. This is a boundless love. Where we're recognizing there's not a single sentient being who is more deserving than ourselves and others. Meaning we're equal in that deserving. It's not that someone else is deserving, we're not deserving. We both are. And therefore, when we see our self-habit as the true cause of our suffering, then we truly start caring for ourselves. Yeah? But again, this has to be built on confidence. So earlier today, yesterday, I was talking a lot on how to build that, because often our self-confidence gets eroded through years and years of trauma and years of not knowing how to have a healthy sense of worth in ourselves or a healthy sense of self-esteem. So sometimes we can't go to exactly what I'm talking about right now, which is to aim right at the self-habit, because we might try to aim at it, but we end up hitting the thing that actually needs to grow, which is the confidence, right? I'm not a big fan of saying like we grow self-esteem, but I would say confidence is something we need to come into. Our self-respect, just a sense of love and care for ourselves, a sense that we are also worthy along with others. And then it doesn't become a battle between who's more worthy of love. Everybody's worthy of it, right? But really, eventually the Buddha says we have to look directly at what the enemy is, self-habit. Our preoccupation with ourselves. Again, I have to you know, as a kind of modern meditation teacher, I have to self-promote and do all this bullshit on Instagram and Facebook. It's a total shit show out there. Total shit show. It's ridiculous, you know? We can mask it however we want. Of course, intention matters, you know, so I can't judge anyone else. I don't know what their intention is. But it's a slippery slope, you know? And we live in a world now where if you don't self-promote, nobody knows what you're doing out there if you're trying to do something, whether it's good or bad, right? And so we have even more mechanisms to deceive ourselves, more mechanisms to create harm, which are not loving, more mechanisms to reify our own importance, right? Or we could do this in other ways, by extending our self-importance into our kids and then reifying their situation. That's another way to actually have self-importance. So anyways, I just felt like delivering a little tough love tonight. But any thoughts on that?
Or? Yeah. I mean, and I think that what you said, the like subtle reflection on self-importance, is that a lot of times the ways in which we're self-important, you know, we're unconscious of. And there's some really simple things that we can do to work on this, like today. The Buddha had said, you know, an early kind of Buddhist text, that what he emphasized before he taught meditation or anything else was service. Yeah. And so if you came up to the Buddha and you're like, hey, I'm miserable and, you know, I'm suffering, he'd say, okay, like, help other people. That's what you should do with your time. And so this, in this way, like, we're not, in a way, like, by judging our neurotic self-importance, we're being more self-important. Like, by making it, like, about who I am, we call this identification or becoming. It's like, I'm a selfish asshole. It's like that identification is like that habit is me. Is suffering. It's just a habit. Like, that's why I like the way Scott's described it. Self-habit. It's a habit. Yeah, it's not my fault. I mean, I'm born into this neurobiological system that craves life. It wants to live as long as possible. So who's it going to think about more than anyone else? Me. You know? And that's if we even look out of the context of potential past lives or, you know. Just in this life, I'm born into a body mind that craves security. I live in a world that doesn't provide lasting security. So I'm constantly concerned with if I am going to survive. What causes human beings to survive? Well, today, money, production, self-promotion, individualism. If we even look at how we engage in, like, you know, social media and wanting recognition, praise, reputation. Again, it's not my fault because it's about security. Like, a lot of the times when we say I feel insecure, we mean that in relationships. All right, so that's an interesting thing. Most of our security is through people. Even from the time we're born, human beings are really interesting because we're not able to survive for like at least a decade after we're born. You're not capable of surviving. You would die. Fortunately, we have people that we're born to and sometimes adopted to, or sometimes, you know, put in unfortunate circumstances to, that take care of us to varying degrees of success and nurturing capabilities, but so maybe not so fortunate. You know, but we're dependent on others. And so our brains are really wired to constantly check. Do you love me? Do you care about me? Am I accepted? Am I safe? And so our self-importance is a self-habit. It's nothing to even really, you know, beat ourselves up about, but it is a hard truth in a way because it's about taking responsibility, right? Like you said earlier, it's not my fault, but it's my responsibility. Taking responsibility for this self-habit. And so starting with something simple like, okay, how do I take responsibility? Maybe I wake up in the morning. I love this because I actually literally do this. You know, not every day, but this is like the foundation of my practice. When I start feeling disconnected from my practice, I wake up a little earlier, I sit a little bit longer, and I just set an intention. And I'm like, just do one act of service. Just focus all my intention on that day and just showing up. And then what Scott said too is really powerful. When I am of service, it's only service if it's selfless, right? So that means we want to really feel into that interaction and that relationship. We want to feel what it's like when we're serving someone, when we're offering. And that's what true generosity is giving. And so, you know, that's just a simple place to kind of practice in. Set an intention, you know, be of service. And then, you know, having this act of generosity of just kind of watching our mind. Presence throughout the day, awareness. I notice I get really self-important when I feel rushed. This is an interesting thing. My sense of self gets stronger with speed. It's almost like a mathematical formula. And I don't do math well, so I'm not going to try to put it into a formula. But it's like something about like when I feel like I'm losing time and things speed up, my sense of kind of contracting gets stronger. You know, and my fear body gets tighter and I get more self-focused. And a lot of times the speed that I feel is complete delusion. You know, it's like I start off the day, I'm a little bit late to work, I get stuck in traffic, my boss comes in and talks to me about it, and then I have 20 emails instead of the normal 10, and now I'm behind and I try to get them all done, but someone comes into my office and wants something else from me. And what happens is just these environmental conditions are coming up. And so sometimes when it's like that, I'm just like, fuck it all for 5 minutes. I'm done with it for 5 minutes. Just pull the, you know, chair back from the desk and just slow back down. You know, because then my self-habit gets to kind of slow down a little bit. And then I get to reassess things. I'm like, you know what? What if these things are really that important? You know, so simple things like that, just slowing down, being of service, having intention, living with intention. And the Buddha talks so much about the importance of karma, really, is intention. It's our motivation. But we're oftentimes not so aware of this subtle level of mind. Like, what is my motivation behind saying what I'm saying right now, or doing what I'm doing right now? And so we're often motivated by fear. We're motivated, and that fear then turns into these bigger things like greed, right? Or anger, resentment, blame. Or comparing, competing. These types of things all stem from fear, basically. And so, I don't know where I was going with that. It was something cool to know. Fear is a big one, right? So, metta was taught as a way to work with fear. And the story is, I'll tell it because I love this. I'm a visual person, and I like to kind of pretend. I don't know whether the Buddha existed or not, or, you know, whatever, but I like to pretend, like, in some of these suttas, like, what it would be like to be around him. And, you know, these monks would go sit these, they call them rains retreats. During the rainy season, it wasn't so great to be walking around ancient India. And so they'd just go and retreat and they'd just practice. But they were practicing like in the jungle and like the forest. And there are all these crazy animals. I don't know like geography or ancient India, but let's just say lions, tigers, and bears. I don't think those three things live in the same place, but... And there's, you know, these tree spirits, or, you know, basically I like to say the monks were afraid of the dark. And they're sitting outside and there's snakes and animals and ghosts and all these things. And they could not practice presence. You know, they could not even really kind of tune into awareness of subtle experience in the mind because their mind was so overwhelmed by the fear. And that's, it said, when the Buddha delivered this sutta to them. As he said, one should sustain this recollection. So he's basically saying, wish these beings, these tree spirits, these animals, like sit and wish them ease and peace, safety and well-being. I mean, that may not stop you from getting eaten, but it's going to train your mind. And this is the ultimate, this is what we're really aiming for. She said, yeah, you might die anyway, but can't really do anything about that. You're already in the jungle, but you can do something about your mind. And so this kindness, right, when we're selfless in that way and we want happiness and well-being for other people and we try to live from that place, you know, there's this something special about that. It's beyond words, really.
Yeah, I was thinking of an example of, so for me, it's like spaces. So when someone's encroaching on my space, that's when I'm, and New York is like, I live in New York, so pretty much everyone's encroaching on your space all the time. So it's been really good for me to work with my self-habit there. And so I get, it's like the speed issue. Like I get, that happens to me too. And the space thing where there's like competition for space. Mm. Competition if I'm in line somewhere or getting on the subway, or I want that spot on the subway because it's more comfortable. I can't get a seat. I want to be against the door so I'm, you know, can lean against it or whatever. And like my excuse is, oh, I'm a big guy. So it's like, I should get that space, right? But, you know, because then I can get out of the way from other people. But it's actually, I just want to be comfortable. Uh-huh. It has nothing to do with anyone else. But anyways, one thing I found really key is, you know, besides service, which is a good one as well, for getting a self-habit, is putting myself in the shoes of others, mm. right? So I was going to offer you to y'all tonight. Some of you look a little sleepy. I don't know how you feel about that. But there's other sleepy people in the room too. Why is your sleepiness the most important sleepiness, you know? They might be more sleepy than you, or more bored, right? Or whatever. So sometimes that really works when we start to do that, because we start to put ourselves in the shoes of another. And it's immediate that we forget what we were fucking worried about in the first place, right? So when I'm on a crowded subway, it's just like, oh, okay. I'm on this crowded subway with 100 other people who are also crowded. Why is my crowdedness the most important? And it starts to shift when I start to think that way. But there's also a love for myself. Again, I'm not becoming a doormat. That's what I meant. Love is like it's an interconnected force. It's not an either or force. And I think that's what we have to cultivate. And so we're simultaneously kind of letting ourselves, we're not like neglecting ourselves. We're just opening up a field of community everywhere we go. And so for some of you, that might be intact and that's not hard for you. And you know, please teach me if that's the case. I really, like I said, I really like when people are just like that naturally. For me, it's something I have to work on. It's not so natural. You know, I have to directly work on it. And that's one of my main practices I do, honestly. It's just put myself in the shoes of others and try to see it from their perspective as much as possible. And there's always room for compassion there. There's always room for love. Because there's no way to then just see it from my own perspective and to ignore that at that point, right? I feel in the modern world, it's so easy to not do this because we have every tool to isolate ourselves, right, from others' experience. We can create literally our own reality just in a room with a computer, you know? We can create a reality that the world is ruled by alien lizards and just sit in that. And no one, we don't have to be challenged by anyone else on that. I think that's kind of unprecedented. For the most part, someone would have had to have been challenged by someone else in history. You know, you couldn't just live isolated on your own. Now we kind of can. We could order Uber Eats so we don't have to leave the house. You know, and get food delivered. And just tune into a news channel that talks about lizard people who run the country, right? Or the world. I'm joking, right? But you don't know what I'm saying. Some people do believe that, by the way. And no offense if you believe that. I don't mean to offend your political or religious.
Yeah, it's not the wildest view. You could have picked like some that are even weirder than that.
Yeah, I find that one pretty wild. And they're also Jews at the same time, I think. Like, they're lizard Jew people who run the world, right? I don't even find that offensive as a Jewish person. I find that hilarious. But anyways, that's a different story. Yeah, so that's just another one to add on. There's service, but there's also like just opening in the moment, right? And shifting and finding our, like, be creative with that. Find ways, like, that's me just being creative. But you can find your own creative ways to do that, you know? Just want to throw that out.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, let's just open it up. Y'all are a part of the discussion, so anything that comes to mind, resonated with you, or that you want to share, I like to always say you don't have to be an expert of anything other than your own lived experience, so please feel free. Questions, comments, thoughts, anything that y'all want to share.
I have a question.
Yeah?
Okay, so I'm just thinking a lot about boundaries and like how to set them in a loving kind way, because there's always an opportunity for aversion in terms of, like, I think of like the spatial stuff of I'm a server and a little silverware and one little small table, and I literally go in with a plan of like I'm gonna stand like this, do that, you know, and then I'm claiming my space. And I can see myself doing it. It's just, you know, but there are other servers that work there. This is just a small example of like something all the time, because I relate a lot to that. And so, you know, seeing my own, you know, like just self-habit there, you know, and then, like, I don't know, it just, like, obviously that might be the best example for creating a boundary, but, you know, there are times, I mean, you bump into people, and it's just sometimes my own aggression sees that as aggression, it's not, and so I'm like, here's your boundary, here's your, and I'm really just isolating myself. So I guess I'd be curious to know how what you all talked about this evening would relate to setting a boundary in a little kind of way, because I don't know, I mean, I've been working on it for a while, but I'm open to hear it, because I can get it.
Like, say, but you're talking about setting a boundary with others or yourself?
Well, with others, really. Yes. Because I can come across very, like, and I can see, I know I can. It's gotten better. I've been more able to look at it. And I can catch it quicker than I used to. But it's just really isolating and, like, unkind, for sure. Yeah. I don't know. Just any insight that you have in terms of, yeah.
One thing I'll say real quick, because I'm interested to hear what Scott has to say on this too. First of all, I heard something that you said that I think is what would be my starting point is you said, like, it can be unkind. And so sometimes I just practice, like, can I do this a little bit kinder? And, like, even just being interested, like, if I'm going to confront someone, for example, and I'm going to set a boundary, like, taking a moment to pause, and I'll almost, like, kind of, like, do, like, a spot check, kind of like, all right, Andrew, you aren't always that kind when you do this. So how could you practice or try to do that with a little bit more kindness? And kindness doesn't have to be niceness. Actually, sometimes the kindest thing to do is to shorten the interaction and to say, hey, this happened. I didn't feel good about it. I wanted to let you know, and I don't want this kind of thing to happen again, period, at the end of the sentence. You know, so that helps. Also, is it the right time? Because that's another thing too. And these are parts of like what the Buddha encouraged us to practice around wise speech. Is it the right time? Because sometimes I want to confront or set a boundary, and I notice because it's so uncomfortable, I want to do it like quickly, or I want to do it like right now. And it's almost always, I can't say every time, but it's almost always better a day or two later. And if I still feel the way I feel about it, then I'm like in a totally regulated place and I'm a lot clearer. And oftentimes I don't feel like I need the boundary a couple days later.
But that space between incident and reaction is, I've noticed, strengthened by this practice.
Right.
So is that?
Like, yeah, totally. Yeah. Like taking that pause. And the last thing real quick is the usefulness of it. Am I clear about the boundary? Is it clearly formulated in my mind what I need? Because a lot of times I'll open my mouth and I think I have a boundary, but really I just have feelings I want to express. And those are two very different things. And they're both valid, you know, but they have different objectives. One is to express feeling. I'm upset that this happened. The other is, this happened and I can't do this anymore, or I need this from you. or else I'll quit, or else I'll... And boundaries are also for ourselves. So we then, this is the last part, have to uphold the boundary. It's up to us to uphold. Because when we let people, when we set a boundary and then we let people cross it, that's on us. So that means sometimes we have to be willing to let go. That's another thing. It's like with relationships, this happens a lot, romantic relationships. I say, I'm not talking to X anymore, my ex. I don't have an ex, but, well, I have many exes, but I don't talk to my exes. I use these examples because these are big ones. I'm not talking to my ex anymore. Okay, but then ex texts and says, hey, you know, did you get my mail? You know, and you're like, yeah, I got your mail. And then you kind of like back in a little bit. And then you know, you're slowly letting your boundaries slip. And instead of just not replying, grabbing the mail, dropping it off on their front door, not, you know, like whatever. So upholding the boundary is another part of it too. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just one thing comes to mind. Just discerning between when we need boundaries and then when we actually, you know, this quote came to mind from a Indian Buddhist saint named Shantideva, who wrote a really famous text called The Way of the Bodhisattva, which is just widely studied in Tibetan Buddhism. And in it, there's a famous quote where he says, so you can either cover the whole entire world with leather or you can cover your feet with leather. He said, what's easier? Mm. And so there is valid room for boundaries, like in the way Andrew said, and they're healthy to put for ourselves and others. And then sometimes we need to be able to discern when we need to cover our own feet. Because what I notice a lot these days is we feel entitled, I'm not saying you, but often people can feel entitled that they can go, that like it's their job to go cover the fucking earth with their ideologies and views, you know? Especially on Facebook, I noticed this. You know? And I'm like, to these people, to me, I don't say anything. I usually just stay quiet because obviously they're suffering. There's a reason they're doing what they're doing. They're deeply suffering. And they don't know it because the self-habit is driving the show. But I think, you know, it's a valid thing to think about. Like when I do this all the time, like similar to that example where on the subway or something, I'll reach out and put myself in the shoes of others. Before I do that, I often just ask my body, what's the need? You know? So it's first checking in with, hey, what do I need here? Like if I'm providing true care and connection to myself first, because a lot of us don't, you know? We sometimes have a little bit of a self-hatred. It can be subtle or it can be a lot, depending on the individual. So this is just more of a modern issue. So that's been my way of dealing with that, is first send the care here, what's my need? And then I can start to send that care to others once I recognize, ooh, can I get my need met here or not? And what's the best avenue to take to get that need met? Is it wrapping my own feet in leather, or is it expressing that need to someone in it, like Andrew said, in a kind way, in an appropriate way, in order to, you know, set a boundary? So I think that's the question, and it's not always easy to discern that. So it's something good to reflect on a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. My Unity teacher this morning was talking about values, and the last couple of weeks have been really. I've been very self-important the last couple of weeks, triggered by some things that some people that I have a conflict with have said about me that are not true. And some opinions of me. So can you talk a little bit about the trigger of when that happens and the need to defend self-importance?
Did you catch it?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is like, you know, when people, so I'll just put it in personal terms. When people are talking about me, you know, the self-importance is also, I need to defend that image. You know, and so I may do a variety of reactive habits may happen out of that place to defend my image, my self-image. You know, I may call my friend up and, you know, gossip or talk shit about that person. I do a lot of just sitting in my head and like ruminating and arguing with the person. You know, I may distract myself and I may abandon all those friends that associate with that person, like the cut and run. So I think it's just about, you know, being aware of the activation and in a like kind of like a in a like non-judgmental way, just like knowing that there feels this need to defend. And a lot of times just practicing like not reacting with it. Like this is what I was talking about earlier, like the patiently bearing with. There's a lot of healing that comes in just patiently bearing with. You know, when someone's talking about me or they're saying something, I also learned in recovery, something I really love is like other people's opinions of me are none of my business. And that's a really great, it's actually a really fucking great, I just thought of that, like, I don't think I practiced that much. But that's a really great practice, is to almost like, there's so much liberation that like, literally what other people say about me has nothing to do with me. Unless they say it to me in the moment, then we can have dialogue. Like, and maybe I need, you know, whatever, even I may need to apply that even if they say it to me.
I was going to say, I added to that, what people say about me is none of my business. But I'd still like to know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Not so much for COVID.
along those lines, there's an image in a quote from a Tibetan Buddhist master I really like where he says, when you're pointing a finger at someone, there's three fingers pointing back at you. And so, again, if we can take the higher road here, because that's what the Metta Sutta and, you know, a little bit in our talk tonight was encouraging, we take the compassionate road, where we recognize this being suffering. Meaning, if they need to take it upon themselves to act out towards us, if we did something generally mistaken, it was our mistake, we can go apologize. That's what it says in the Way of the Bodhisattva. And as a Bodhisattva, we train in cherishing others, and we want awakening for others in ourselves. And so we decide to always kind of take the higher ground, which is usually patience, love, for compassion. And we recognize, okay, we apologize when we're mistaken. If we're not mistaken, we can have compassion for that person in their ignorance, you know, and not knowing, which is a hard thing. And I think, personally, what I do, if it's affecting something, meaning, if there's a reputation thing that's not just my selfish idea of my image, but it's actually going to affect others, or it's going to affect something in a negative way, then I might take an action that's appropriate, just trying to work out the situation a little bit from a way of respecting that person as well, which is I think really tough. But there's something around that where people disarm. I heard a really beautiful story. I don't know if it's true. Is anybody a fan of Byron Katie? I don't know her work that much, but a lot of people love her. But apparently, she got robbed at gunpoint at one time, and I guess I don't know if I. Well, I don't want to say anyone's telling. You know, she said I think it was like the guy pointed a gun at her stomach, but I don't usually people don't get that close. But anyways, you know, and so she just looked at the guy, and apparently in the story, just saw like a being who was really suffering and then chose to hug him, and that was it. And then the guy just walked away, you know. So whether it's true or not, it's a nice story. It's a nice metaphor for how we can interact. Again, it's like we have to, just to give the premise though, we have to be doing a lot of work on ourselves to be able to be at that, you know, meaning like we can shoot for that. But we have to have the work to have the self-respect and the compassion at the same time. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. A lot of people think we need to, like, someone does us wrong, we need to let them know out of self-respect. I actually don't call that self-respect. That's not true self-respect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's self-defense.
Yeah.
And you know, when we defend the self, we fortify it. And fortification, I think the definition is something like to strengthen a weak place against attack. So when we self-defend, we actually keep ourselves in with the self that we're trying to protect. And that self's a hurt self. And that self really wants to be free. And so it's a hard practice. So, and this is probably a good place to wrap up too. But like Scott was saying earlier, all of these things are invitations, all these things meaning like what we're all talking about, for your own reflection. Because, right, like this is, I like to always say, self-awareness isn't always good news, but it's good information.
Yeah.
And so we just want to be radically honest and interested, genuinely interested, and not identified with us being the one that's bad, or us being the one that's selfish, or us being the one that's, you know, we want to just be honest. And almost by being radically honest in that way, we don't, like, for me, that's where like the liberation happens. There's something freeing about just saying basically like, this hurts, and this is confusing, and this is hard. And that's where the patiently bearing with, it's like, and can I meet this pain with awareness, and can I be genuinely interested in what's going to lead towards my happiness and what's going to lead to more suffering?
Yeah, and I can kind of, can just, that was beautiful, to add on to it just before we close this, I consider this us, like us work. You know what I'm saying? It's like, can we move into more spaces of, like, this doesn't have to be my work or their work. It's like the work we're doing together, even if the other person doesn't know they're doing it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's their choice if they want to do it or not. They might not. But I can still consider it as like community work.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so this is really hard work, what we're talking about tonight. We're talking about a lifetime of work, essentially, of going inwards and really checking. You know, I do it all the time, like, because I'm kind of a rebellious person, so I don't just like believe something if I read it in a Buddhist text. I have to try it. And so, you know, I'm still trying the self-added one, you know, and I still see every time I get caught in it, yeah, I'm not a happy person. You know, usually my self-esteem tanks, my self-confidence tanks. I can spiral into kind of like bouts of not quite depression, but kind of being down. And then I recognize, oh yeah, like I was in the middle of Union Square the other day and I was kind of down and having a bad day. And I was like, wait a second, why am I having a bad day? And I recognized at that moment, I was viewing all the other people around me unconsciously as just like not people, just people in my way as obstacles to where I need to go, you know, because New York just fills with people walking everywhere. And then I was like, oh yeah, that's what's happening. I'm stuck in my self-habit. And then right when I remembered that, I came out of it because I started to think of others. So it doesn't have to be also some big, huge Jesus moment. It's like, you know, like it can really just be something really simple. It doesn't make us a saint. It just makes us a person. And then we need support. That was the last thing I was going to say. So it's a we thing, meaning like, when you come together in things like this, or in your families or communities or with friends, rely on each other. We can't do this alone. We need each other. And that's okay. Like, it doesn't make us weak. I think that makes us stronger, right? For me, I feel one of my biggest weaknesses is not relying on others enough. Like, thinking I can just do it alone all the time.